From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, two novelists with titles on the bestseller lists. Khaled Hosseini's latest book is called A Thousand Splendid Sons. For his debut novel, The Kite Runner, Hosseini wanted to recapture the Afghanistan of his childhood, before the Soviet invasion, the Taliban, and Osama bin Laden. Also, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jeffrey Eugenides. His book, Middlesex, is also at the top of the charts. Later, TV critic David Biancooley previews a four-week anthology series called Masters of Science Fiction, airing Sunday on ABC. And folk songs for far-out folk. This classic 1958 jazz album has just been reissued. Kevin Whitehead has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. It's pretty rare that the New York Times bestseller lists have two titles from the same author. A Thousand Splendid Sons is the second novel by our guest Khaled Hosseini. It's the Times' number one bestseller in fiction this week. His debut novel, The Kite Runner, is still on the list in paperback. Both stories are inspired by Hosseini's own experiences. He grew up in Afghanistan just before the Soviet invasion of 1979. His father was a diplomat. In fact, at the time of the Soviet invasion, Hosseini's father was working at the Afghan embassy in Paris. The family requested and received political asylum in the United States. They moved to San Jose, California in 1980, where Hosseini still lives. Hosseini is a physician, but with the success of his novels, he's chosen to set his practice aside and concentrate on writing. Terry Gross spoke to Khaled Hosseini in 2005 after his first novel, The Kite Runner, was published. She asked him if he ever encountered people reading the novel.
I was on a flight, and I was sitting next to a lady who was reading the book and kind of surreptitiously crying, and she would like dab at her eyes with a napkin now and then. And I was somewhat tempted to tell her who I was, but then I figured there would be this whole, she was reading the paperback and there was no author photo, and she would ask, how do I know it's you? And I would have to quote some line or, God forbid, show an ID. Yeah, I mean, the embarrassing logistics of it always kind of overshadows the romanticism of it for me.
Well, the main character in The Kite Runner is the son of a wealthy businessman in Kabul, and he grows up best friends with the son of one of the family's servants. Now, they're of different ethnic groups, and one is Sunni and one is Shia Muslim. Who is, I assume the main character is very loosely based on your life. What about his friend? Who was that based on?
Well, I had a similar socioeconomic kind of background and upbringing to the main character, Amir. And like him, there were, in his household, there were always people working in around my house. And I had a friendship with one of them, a man much older than myself. He was probably in his 30s. And he was an ethnic Hazara, like the character of Hassan. And he was a cook. And I struck up a friendship with him. And we became close. And he was kind of my partner in flying kites. And he would take me out to the movies and play in the park with me and so on. I remember him as a very affable, kind, gentle man, and almost angelic in a certain way, which I'm sure influenced the writing of this character of Hassan, who in his own way is very kind of angelic. So I loosely based Hassan on this man that I knew from my own childhood.
And I believe you taught him how to read.
Yeah, he was. He was illiterate, and in fact, his whole, he told me no one in his family had ever gone to school. He was from a very rugged, mountainous area in central Afghanistan, where there really wasn't much in way of institutions. And so he was illiterate, and at the time, I was in about third grade. And in the course of our friendship, one thing led to another, and I kind of became his impromptu teacher and taught him the alphabet, and he took it from there, and I would assign him homework, and he would practice reading and writing. And by the time he left the household, he was reading children's books and beginning to read the newspaper very slowly. So, and that's something that sort of made its way into the novel as well.
You grew up in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion and, of course, before the Taliban came to power. What did you want to capture in your novel about what life was like in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion?
Well, you know, for so long, and maybe justifiably so, Afghanistan's been totally synonymous with the Soviet war or, you know, the opium trade or the Taliban or bin Laden. But the fact was there was an Afghanistan before all of those things. And in fact, that's the only Afghanistan I know that I remember from my childhood, having grown up in the 1970s before the communist coup. So I kind of wanted to recreate that lost time and era in at least the first third of this book, and to kind of bring life a sweeter, more innocent Kabul that I remember from my childhood, and to remind the reader that Afghanistan wasn't always about the caves of Tora Bora and bombings and landmines and so on, that there was a better time in that country's history and not that long ago. It just seems a very long time ago. So I wanted to recreate the Afghanistan of my own childhood, which I remember with a great deal of fondness.
What's one of your fondest memories about your neighborhood?
Well, I mean, you say Kabul to me, and I think kites. And it's not surprising. It's before any of the characters, the kites came first when I wrote this book, and so maybe my fondest memories revolve around the winters in Kabul when schools were out, and we had these 3 months of freedom to run around and cause trouble with my cousins and my brothers, and inevitably a kite tournament would break out, and we would build our kites and buy our glass strings and fly kites all day. So that's almost by word association what I think of when I think of those years.
My guest is Khalid Hosseini, and he is the author of the bestseller, The Kite Runner. You left Kabul when you were 11. Your father was a diplomat, and he was sent to the Afghanistan embassy in France. What was his position in the embassy?
Well, he was two positions below the ambassador. There were three secretaries working at the embassy, and he was secretary number two. So he was working as basically an attaché, a diplomat in the embassy.
So you were in Paris when you heard that the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan?
Yeah, we were home having dinner, and there was a news break, and I saw on the television, we saw pictures of these Soviet tanks kind of rolling in, and I remember thinking with a very sinking feeling that we would never see Afghanistan again. And it was shortly after that my father began kind of covertly making preparations to move the family to the States.
This may be obvious, but what were some of the reasons why your parents would not consider bringing the family back to Afghanistan?
Well, there were mass executions going on at the time, and anybody affiliated with the previous regime was in danger. I said my father was the second secretary. The third secretary, who had become friends with the family, he ended up going back during the communist years, and he took his family back to Kabul. And unfortunately, shortly after that, we heard that he had been executed. So that was a very loud and clear message.
At what point did it register on you that you really couldn't go home again?
When my father revealed to us shortly before we came to the States that he had applied for political asylum and that we were going to go to a place called San Jose in California, he said it was on the west coast of the U.S. and that we weren't to tell anybody about this, that it would have to be a secret within the family, and within days we were gone. And it felt permanent. It felt like we weren't just moving, but rather relocating and really planning on starting a new life.
So your father got asylum in the United States for your family, but when you moved here, your family went from privilege. Your father had been a diplomat from Afghanistan. Your family went from privilege to basically to welfare. How did your parents handle that change in status?
I think, in retrospect, very gracefully. There wasn't much in the way of woebegone expressions and lamenting and that sort of thing. I think they were blessed with a really good sense of perspective that as far as Afghans went, they were in a pretty good situation in California and safe. The being on welfare part of it was very hard on them, particularly on my dad. Both of my parents had always been sort of on the giving end of charity, and for them to live with the notion of being on the receiving end of it was a very hard blow to their pride. And so we didn't stay on welfare very long, just a couple of months, and my father volunteered us out and began working a number of jobs, as did my mother.
Didn't he eventually end up working for welfare?
Yeah, he first became a driving instructor, and so to this day, he is the most reliable direction giver that I know. But in an ironic twist, he eventually found a job as a social worker with the city of Santa Clara, and now he's actually dispensing welfare to immigrant families.
Author Khaled Hussaini speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with author Khaled Hussaini.
We talked a little bit about what it was like for your family when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. What about when the Taliban came to power? Did you realize at first what an extremist regime it would be?
Well, not at first. I think initially everybody was relieved that the war was over. And by the war, I mean the horrible, horrible infighting between the various Mujahideen factions between 92 and 96, which did what the Soviets didn't do, that is, destroy Kabul completely. And so there was a sense of relief that finally there was stability. But it was very short-lived because stories began to leak out and people began to talk about what the Taliban were doing in Afghanistan. And so what relief there was to be enjoyed from the end of the war was quickly overshadowed by the knowledge of what the Taliban were imposing on the people.
Do you have any old friends who actually became members of the Taliban?
No, God, no. You know, most of the Taliban, I mean, I'm 40 now, and most of the Taliban were young boys during the Soviet war, and they were often boys who were fatherless and had to kind of languish in refugee camps in Pakistan and were put in these madrasas and were taught this very harsh brand of Islam. So it's a different generation. I think most of them tend to be were younger men.
I imagine that when you came to the United States that your friends who weren't Afghans knew very little about Afghanistan. But that probably changed after September 11th and certainly after the United States started bombing Afghanistan in an attempt to drive out the Taliban and capture bin Laden. What was it like for you when suddenly your country was in the news and people who wouldn't be able to find it on the map suddenly had a position on your country?
Yeah, it was bizarre that suddenly everybody was interested in Afghanistan and they were talking about Mazar-e-Sharif and Qunduz and these towns that of course I knew about, but suddenly they were headlines on newspapers and television. It was very, very disorienting. I experienced September 11th and the aftermath of it in two distinct ways. One, as somebody who had lived in America for more than 20 years. So the sense of outrage and shock at the atrocity of it was registered with me as with any other American. But I also experienced it as an Afghan, especially when it became evident that the regime in Afghanistan had a hand in protecting the folks who would cause this problem. And so I felt, very ambivalent about what was going to happen in Afghanistan. On the one hand, here was an opportunity for this very brutal regime to end, but it also meant more bombing and more killing and the loss of more innocent lives. So it was very, very difficult and kind of a tumultuous time for us.
Another thing about your novel, a lot of the story is really propelled by guilt. And I won't give away what it is that makes this character so guilty throughout his life. But was there a counterpart for you that made you think about the weight of carrying around one action that you regret forever and that you try eventually to compensate for?
Not so much that, but I think when you talk to people who the diaspora, people who live in exile, where their native country is being demolished, there's always this, at least for me, there always has been this undercurrent of guilt about my own good fortunes and my own life. And I have thought from time to time about people that I knew in Afghanistan who were poor, who worked as cooks and gardeners, and I wonder what has happened to them. I've thought about Hossein Khan, this man who I was friends with, who was a cook in my household, many times, and wonder, if he's even alive or what has happened to him. And there's this always this kind of sense of guilt and unease, like an undercurrent. And so when I was writing this character of Amir, that was something that was always there. His guilt, it was pervasive. And so it became kind of this theme in the book. But I think a lot of it stems just from the way that I view my own life.
Are there traditions from Afghanistan that you still keep?
Well, in my household, I think everything begins with language. So I speak Farsi to my children. My son, who's four, is completely bilingual. My daughter is learning both languages. I think it starts with that. But there are, wedding traditions that are kept in our community. I observe Ramadan. I'm not a stringent Muslim, but I do observe it almost in a cultural kind of way. And then at the end of Ramadan, there are 3 days of feasts where you go and visit family and relatives, and we invariably do that. So there are Afghan traditions that we try to keep, but inevitably it kind of becomes diluted by the ambient environment and the culture around us, which is so overpowering.
You mentioned the traditions of weddings. In your novel, The Kite Runner, the father spends $35,000, nearly the balance of his life savings, on his son's wedding ceremony. Did your father do that for your wedding?
Yeah, God bless him. He dug deep in his pockets and threw a wonderful wedding. We had over, I think, 600 people show up to the wedding. About 500 of them were invited. And so it was this big affair, and my dad paid for it.
You know a lot of people.
Well, Afghans are very social creatures. This goes back to the way of life in Afghanistan, where, in the 60s and 70s, there wasn't much to do. And there's a wonderful line from a friend of mine who's a writer, Tamim Ansari, who wrote in his book, West of Kabul, East of New York. He said, in the West, you have television. In Afghanistan, we had genealogy. So people sat around, and they talked about who's related to who and this very complex network of how people are connected. And so those connections and those relations stay with you. And so when your oldest son is getting married, it seems almost unthinkable to omit people. So, yeah, there was a lot of people.
You grew up in Kabul and I grew up in Brooklyn. One of the cultural things we have in common is that we both loved The Magnificent Seven when we were growing up.
Ah.
And I assume you did anyways, because your main character does. So I assume he's speaking for you on that account.
Yeah.
And your character sees it 13 times. and also learns the hard way that you're not supposed to reveal the ending of movies to friends in the United States. Friends who haven't seen the movie. And you say the opposite is true in Afghanistan, that people always want to know, do they find happiness at the ending? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember you go see a film and they say, well, is it a happy ending or sad ending? Do they die at the end? And that's like the first thing they want to know. So you tell them, no, it has a happy ending. And then people would go with some sense of, I guess, security to see the film. But I learned, as you say, kind of the hard way that there's a word for that in the States. It's called spoiling it. And so it's you're not supposed to do that.
So what did you love about The Magnificent Seven?
Oh, God. Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Charles Bronson. Seven guys against the whole gang. What's there not to like? It was mythical. I loved it.
So you loved an American Western when you were growing up. When you found out you were going to be moving to the western part of the United States, did you expect to find guys on horses there?
Up until the time when we moved to Paris, I actually did. And I thought there were really two kinds of Americans, cowboys and hippies. And so I was convinced that that's what I would find if I ever went to the States. This was in the 70s, and there was this influx of the hippie culture in Kabul.
Oh, sure.
There were opium houses and hashish everywhere, very cheap, and everybody was friendly. And so most of my contact with Westerners at that time was with hippies. And then the cowboys from the movies. Then I moved to France, and I gradually realized that, not all Westerners are hippies, and there really aren't that many cowboys. Judging by what I was seeing on television from the U.S. And so by the time I came here, I was 15, and sadly, all those childhood ideas were gone.
Writer Khaled Husseini speaking with Terry Gross in 2005. His debut novel, The Kite Runner, is still on the paperback bestseller list. His latest bestseller is A Thousand Splendid Suns. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, folk songs for far-out folk. Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of the 1958 album. And we talk with novelist Jeffrey Eugenides, whose Pulitzer Prize-winning book Middlesex remains at the top of the bestseller list. Also, David Bean Cooley previews Masters of Science Fiction, a new anthology series premiering this weekend on ABC. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. In the mid-1950s, Fred Katz was a pioneer of jazz cello in drummer Chico Hamilton's quartet. Katz also played piano behind singers like Lena Horne and arranged albums by Carmen McRae and word jazz artist Ken Nordine. In 1958, Katz made an album of his own where he didn't play but conducted his versions of global folk tunes. It's just been reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the record was way ahead of its time.
The traditional ballad, Foggy, Foggy Dew, in an arrangement more spooky than foggy. Mysterious, but with an anvil edge. Fred Katz uses a familiar-sounding melody to take you to an unfamiliar place, and then keeps displacing you. You drift like you're in a dream. The terrain shifts under your feet. John Williams on piano, showing he knew something about drama before writing the theme to Jaws. Foggy Foggy Dew reminds me of some super hip 1990s Dutch music, but Fred Katz often sounds prophetic on 1958's Folk Songs for Far Out Folk, just reissued on Reboot Stereophonic. The first part of Mateka sounds like minimal or post-minimal music by Terry Riley or Steve Reich, except years too early. Like Katz, they'd apply West African-ish interlocking rhythm patterns to European instruments. Katz had worked from a musicologist's transcriptions, but no longer remembers whose or what countries the music came from. Anyway, after that opening, drums take over, and Mateka sounds like Max Roach's 70s percussion band, M Boom. Katz conducts three groups on his globetrotting album. The Pan-African pieces are for six brass and five percussion. The quintet that plays Americana, from Foggy Foggy Dew to Motherless Child, is a pileup of jazz rhythm instruments, piano, guitar, vibes, bass, and drums. Two very old Hebrew songs are set for a sextet of woodwinds and upright bass, lots of clarinet, but no klezmer licks. Paul Horn and Buddy Collette on flutes behind Justin Gordon's bass clarinet. You could say that number looks ahead as well, to New York's Jewish improvisers digging into their roots in the 1990s. Fred Katz was so far out front, he studied the Kabbalah in the 50s. Still, in some ways, his music is of its time, with echoes of Afro-Cuban bands, West Coast Cool, the Modern Jazz Quartet, and George Russell's Jazz Workshop records. Some of it also recalls the kind of Hollywood exotica associated with movies set in the jungle but shot at the L.A. Zoo. Even so, Folk Songs for Far Out Folk is a gem. Without meaning to, Fred Katz forecasts the music's future by looking to its past.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Folk Songs for Far Out Folk by Fred Katz on the Reboot Stereophonic label. Next, a coming-of-age story about a hermaphrodite. This is Fresh Air. You may know Jeffrey Eugenides as the author of the novel The Virgin Suicides, which was adapted into a film. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2003 for his second novel, Middlesex. It's now the book to read in Oprah's book club. The narrator of the story was born in 1960 and starts life as a girl named Callie. But as she approaches puberty, she realizes she isn't like other girls. She eventually discovers she was born a hermaphrodite, and she's becoming more physically masculine with age. In her early teens, she abandons her identity as a woman, changes her name from Callie to Cal, and begins to live as a man. The story also covers the two preceding generations of the narrator's family, starting with his Greek immigrant grandparents. When the book was released, the New York Times said the novel turns the story of Cal's coming of age into an uproarious epic, at once funny and sad, about misplaced identities and family secrets. Eugenides has delivered a deeply affecting portrait of one family's tumultuous engagement with the American 20th century. Terry spoke with Jeffrey Eugenides in 2002. Let's start with the author reading a passage from Middlesex.
I was born twice. First as a baby girl on a remarkably smogless Detroit day in January of 1960, and then again as a teenage boy in an emergency room near Petoskey, Michigan in August of 1974. Specialized readers may have come across me in Dr. Peter Luce's study, Gender Identity in 5 Alpha Reductase Pseudohermaphrodites, published in the Journal of Pediatric Endocrinology in 1975. Or maybe you've seen my photograph in Chapter 16 of the now sadly outdated Genetics and Heredity. That's me on page 578, standing naked beside a height chart, with a black box covering my eyes. My birth certificate lists my name as Calliope Helen Stefanides. My most recent driver's license from the Federal Republic of Germany records my first name simply as Cal. I'm a former field hockey goalie, long-standing member of the Save the Manatee Foundation, rare attendant at the Greek Orthodox liturgy, and, for most of my adult life, an employee of the U.S. State Department. Like Tiresias, I was first one thing, and then the other. I've been ridiculed by classmates, guinea-pigged by doctors, palpated by specialists, and researched by the March of Dimes. A red-headed girl from Grosse Pointe fell in love with me, not knowing what I was. Her brother liked me, too. An army tank led me into urban battle once. A swimming pool turned me into myth. I've left my body in order to occupy others. And all this happened before I turned 16.
That's Jeffrey Eugenides reading the beginning of his new novel, Middlesex. Jeffrey, why did you want to write about a contemporary hermaphrodite?
Well, the first kernel of the idea came to me when I read an actual memoir of a 19th century hermaphrodite that Michel Foucault found in the archives of the French Public Department of Hygiene. And I thought this would be a very interesting book, and went and read it and was filled with frustration because the hermaphrodite in question, Herculine Barbin, was a convent school girl, or at least in her early years. And when she came to write the story of her life, she wrote very much like a convent school girl. I actually brought the diary with me in case you wanted to hear some of it. But
oh, she, yeah, you bet. Why don't you read a few lines from it?
I will. This is midway through her memoirs when she has fallen in love with her best friend at the convent school. And this is the first night they spend together. Happy about this pretext, which was only too true, one evening I asked my friend to share my bed. She accepted with pleasure. It would be impossible to express the happiness I felt from her presence at my side. I was wild with joy. We talked for a long time before going to sleep, I with my arms encircling her waist, she with her face resting near my own. My God, was I guilty? And must I accuse myself here of a crime? No, no. That fault was not mine, it was the fault of an unexampled fatality, which I could not resist, 3 exclamation points. Henceforth, Sarah belonged to me, 2 exclamation points. She was mine, 3 exclamation points. It sort of goes on in that fashion, and I was just terribly frustrated because she was evasive about her story and all of the things I wanted to know about a hermaphrodite's life she was unable to tell me, and I got the idea of writing my own story. And in contrast with the way most hermaphrodites in literature have been handled, usually as mythical creatures or as fanciful creations like Orlando and Virginia Woolf, I wanted to write a story about a real-life hermaphrodite and be accurate as possible as I could about the medical facts and the biological circumstances.
What's the medical explanation for your main character's condition?
Well, it's a very rare genetic mutation, and the condition is called 5-alpha reductase deficiency syndrome. And it occurs in very isolated communities. What it basically is, if you inherit this mutation, your body is unable to respond to certain androgens or male hormones for a long time. So as you're formed in the womb, you would have an XY chromosome, you would be male, and you would be born looking very, very much like a girl, almost undetectably so. And at puberty, as testosterone gets stronger in your blood, you would then virilize and become quite masculine in appearance. So it's one of the most dramatic hermaphroditic conditions that exists, and that's one of the reasons it appealed to me. But in that it was usually occurring only in inbred communities and isolated communities, I then saw a chance to make this story, broaden this story from a fictional memoir of a hermaphrodite to a story about an entire family, a Greek-American family in this case, and the transmission of this gene down through the generations until it finally is inherited by the narrator and flowers in her body, and later as a man she tells the story.
And since this genetic condition happens in inbred populations, you have this character's grandparents being not only husband and wife, but also brother and sister. And the character's parents are not only husband and wife, but also second cousins. Why did you want to explore that kind of familial, marital relationship?
Well, the inbreeding was demanded by the genetic condition I was using. And to bring in mythology again, of course... Zeus and Hera, I believe, are brother and sister in Greek mythology. And so I was playing with some of these ideas, ancient ideas in literature. I needed to dramatize inbreeding. And inbreeding is actually quite boring. It takes generations and generations and centuries. And so in order to dramatize that, it required me to speed up the process and to actually... Have grandparents be siblings. It seemed to me to be the best way to dramatize, you know, what was going on at a cellular level.
Now, in the beginning of your book, Middlesex, the narrator explains that he was born as a girl and reborn as a teenage boy in an emergency room at the age of 14. What happens in the emergency room?
Well, in the emergency room is the first time when someone other than Callie sees her anatomy in in bright light. At that point, Callie is 14. She still looks like a girl, though a flat-chested one. But after an accident, she's taken to the emergency room, and in undressing her to see if she has any broken bones, the doctor does see her genitals, which at that point would be not characteristic or entirely characteristic of a girl of her age.
And why does your character decide to be a boy?
Well, it's a long process and a difficult one for her. The condition that she has, of course, is so virilizing that after she goes through puberty, she would basically have musculature, facial hair, and a deep voice, and would appear to be male. So it would be easier at least to operate in society as a male. And Cal, as he talks about his life in Berlin as an adult, he's careful to say that he operates in society as a male. It's not clear whether he considers himself a regular man or a regular guy, but it is the way that he most easily can get along.
He seems to have a consciousness of what he is, which is something that's strictly neither 100% male nor 100% female.
Right. But I think in terms of the book itself, because Callie falls in love with her best friend, that did provide a certain impetus for her decision to be a boy. But then, of course, when she goes to the gender identity clinic, she does find out about her chromosomal status being XY, and that is another reason why she finally decides to adopt a male gender identity.
When she decides to adopt a male gender identity, she has to learn the outward characteristics of men. I want you to read a paragraph, this is on page 449, in which your main character describes that kind of transformation of learning to walk and talk like a male.
Like a convert to a new religion, I overdid it at first. Somewhere near Gary, Indiana, I adopted a swagger. I rarely smiled. My expression throughout Illinois was the Clint Eastwood squint. It was all bluff, but so was it on most men. We were all walking around squinting at each other. My swagger wasn't that different from what lots of adolescent boys put on, trying to be manly. For that reason, it was convincing. Its very falseness made it credible. Now and then I fell out of character. Feeling something stuck to the bottom of my shoe, I kicked up my heel and looked back over my shoulder to see what it was, rather than crossing my leg in front of me and twisting up my shoe. I picked correct change from my open palm instead of my trouser pocket. Such slips made me panic, but needlessly. No one noticed. I was aided by that. As a rule, people don't notice much.
I wonder if when you wrote that, you thought back to your own puberty and when you were going through the process of turning into a man from having been a boy, and if you felt that you were acting in a way, acting the role of man.
This continues to be something that I feel like I do. In order to get those characteristics that I thought were more common amongst females than males, I didn't think back to my early years. I actually walked around my room trying to imagine how do girls usually look at things when they're stuck to their shoe? How do they count change? And it actually took me a long time to come up with just those few examples that seemed to me evidently female or male.
Well, Jeffrey Eugenides, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Author Jeffrey Eugenides speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His Pulitzer Prize-winning novel is Middlesex. Coming up, Masters of Science Fiction. This is Fresh Air. Saturday night at 10, ABC presents a new 4-week anthology series called Masters of Science Fiction. TV critic David Bianculli is thrilled by the series, but not by its scheduling.
I think I love anthology series for the same reasons the networks generally hate them. Each week is different. Every installment starts from scratch, with new sets, new stories, and an entirely new cast. And you don't have any idea what's going to happen. Unlike weekly series with continuing characters, you don't even know who's going to live. If you're a network, that's tough to swallow and tougher to promote. But in the early days of television, the anthology gave us such fantastic dramas, performed live no less, as Patty Chayefsky's Marty and Rod Serling's Patterns. Serling went on to create and host The Twilight Zone, which, like Alfred Hitchcock Presents and The Outer Limits and Thriller, expanded imaginations and the boundaries of TV in the 50s and 60s. But now what? Steven Spielberg tried to bring back the spirit of those ambitious anthology series with his amazing stories on NBC. But even his clout and passion couldn't make a go of it. That was more than 20 years ago. On broadcast TV, there have been very few tries since. That's why ABC's development of Masters of Science Fiction is so exciting. This show doesn't just attempt to recapture the best anthology series of old. It succeeds. It's a modern-day Outer Limits, with stories so inventive and so excitingly intelligent, Rod Serling would have presented them with pride. Who does present them? No less than Stephen Hawking. Here's how he introduces the show's first installment, A Clean Escape, based on the short story by John Kessel.
Are there events so impossible to forget that they become too painful to remember?
Adapted by Sam Egan and directed by Mark Rydell, A Clean Escape is a brilliant duel of wits between an army psychiatrist and a forgetful patient, set 24 years in the future. The patient is played by Sam Waterston. He seems to have no idea why he's being examined and questioned, and very little memory of certain subjects. The psychiatrist is played by Judy Davis, and she thinks he's faking. When he visits her office, one of her seemingly simple tests involves covering a paperweight with a handkerchief.
I'm not sure I'm in the right place.
You are. Please, sit down. Want some water?
No, I'm... Did I have an appointment?
You're right on time.
Pride myself on that, being punctual.
It's a lost art.
I've always said so. And you are?
Dr. Evans.
This is a hospital?
May I ask you some questions?
The nurse's station, they directed me.
I'd like to start with a little game.
Game? What sort of game?
I want you to watch what I'm doing.
Are you going to make that disappear?
What's under the handkerchief?
Can we place a bet on it?
Not this time.
Let's see, a paperweight?
Wonderful.
What's so wonderful about that? Well, before too long, he can't identify what's hidden under the handkerchief. And the next time he visits the doctor's office, he doesn't seem to remember her either. What's going on here, and who is he really? Watch, and I promise you'll be surprised and impressed. Waterston and Davis are astoundingly good in what amounts to an intense, hour-long, two-character stage play. Other shows on Masters of Science Fiction are impressive, too. Next week, an adaptation of the Howard Fast story The Awakening stars Terry O'Quinn from Lost as a man investigating one of several emotional close encounters of the third kind. The week after that, Malcolm McDowell and Anne Heche star in a funny yet pointed adaptation of a Robert A. Heinlein story about humanoid robots. And wrapping up the series is the best installment of all, The Discarded, starring Brian Dennehy and John Hurt as mutant outcasts on a maroon spaceship. The story, impeccably acted, is adapted from a short story by Harlan Ellison and is adapted by Ellison himself, working with History of Violence screenwriter Josh Olson. The Discarded may seem like an obvious allegory about the AIDS epidemic, except that Ellison wrote his short story way back in 1959. That's the year, by the way, that The Twilight Zone was launched. And all these years later, both the story and the anthology series seem just as fresh and daring. So why am I so angry about how ABC is scheduling this series by executive producer Keith Addison Company? Because Masters of Science Fiction has been sitting on ABC's shelf for a while now. It wasn't broadcast at mid-season, or even at the end of the season. But mind-numbing junk like National Bingo Night, that made the cut, no problem. Broadcast networks almost never put on a first-run TV series on Saturday nights anymore. The viewership is too low to bother. Saturday nights at 10, that's even worse. And Saturday nights in August, let's just say ABC Entertainment President Stephen McPherson couldn't bury this series any deeper if he used a backhoe. But Masters of Science Fiction is a buried treasure, and it's absolutely worth the effort to find it. Imagine, if you will, a fresh scripted show featuring real actors and real ideas in the middle of summer. It's almost like you're in the Twilight Zone. And in the best way possible, you are.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Masters of Science Fiction begins Saturday night on ABC. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from creditcards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards, on the web at creditcards.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, high-stakes confrontations with the Bush administration over Alberto Gonzalez, Iraq, and other issues. We talk with New York Times reporter Carl Hulse about the current state of the U.S. Congress. Join us for the next Fresh Air.